This Do Lectures episode features entrepreneur, author and podcaster Tim Ferriss, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2008.
All right. Well, it's a privilege to be here. Thank you all for having me here. And I do want to jump right into it. So after Tamsin's presentation, I actually rethought my entire presentation. So if it's a little rough, then you'll have to forgive me. I do want to provide plenty of time for Q&A at the end, so I'll just get started. As a bit of background on myself, a few things. Let's see. I wasn't able to swim until about 2 weeks ago. Still have a lot of trouble reading. I was mildly dyslexic at a young age. Still have dysgraphia, so it's extremely difficult for me to write. Letters end up backwards and upside down and so forth. There are a lot of things I'm very bad at. But on the flip side, there are a few things I've done that might be worth mentioning in the context of this presentation. So among the stranger things, I'm the only American to hold a Guinness World Record in tango, Argentine tango. I will come back to why. I will come back to why this is relevant. From first class to world championship was 5 months. I have been a guest lecturer at Princeton University on the East Coast in the U.S. in high-tech entrepreneurship, which is, among other things, electrical engineering, and includes students from undergraduates all the way up to 40-something PhDs, parents, etc., who are doing continuing studies. I was national champion in Chinese kickboxing in 1999. From first preparation to competition was 4 weeks. And I have a number of other examples like that. But the point I'm trying to make, I'm not listing those accomplishments to impress you with what I've done, but to impress upon you that one thing that I do think I've refined is the ability to deconstruct very complex tasks or tasks of large scale and to make them achievable. And not only that, but that the reason I've been able to achieve what most people would consider impossible or unattainable is precisely because they consider them impossible or unattainable. And to illustrate that, I want to provide a case study of sorts, which is from 2005, and it comes from my class at Princeton. So I just finished my presentation, and I'd issued my challenge, the challenge, which is now somewhat well known. And the challenge was simple, but it wasn't easy. Those are two very different things. So the challenge was to contact three seemingly impossible to reach celebrities of some type, whether that's Bill Clinton, J-Lo, J.D. Salinger. It made no difference to me. To contact at least three people and get one of them to answer three questions. And I offered recommendations and some training for this. And 20 students came up to me afterwards because the prize was a round trip anywhere in the world. And with my help doing a number of other things, planning, setting up this trip, and so forth. So 20 students showed up, and they're all frothing at the mouth, very excited to get started, and gave them the details. And I was amazed by how many people completed the challenge, which was a grand total of zero. None of them completed the challenge. And they gave various reasons for this, whether it was, oh, I had to prepare for a test, I had to complete my thesis, it was too hard, I tried this, I didn't get a response, didn't have the time. But they were all paraphrased equivalents indicating two real reasons. Number one, the perceived difficulty was too high for them to even begin. And secondly, they expected to be outdone by the competition. They expected everyone else to do a better job and to put in more time and more effort. Therefore, no one put in any effort. So by the default win rules I'd set, if someone had simply sent me a sloppy one-paragraph description of how miserably they had failed, they would have received this round trip anywhere in the world. And I told this cautionary note the next semester to the same class, 60 different students, and 6 of 17 people completed the challenge. The second class was actually less capable than the first, but they had the trigger finger to actually seek out and try to find these unreachables. And among others, this is, keep in mind, students who've never tried this before, CEO of Hewlett-Packard, George Bush Sr., Warren Buffett, the richest man on the planet, Tommy Hilfiger, the list goes on and on. These are all people they got to write either handwritten responses or get them on the phone, et cetera. So what I'd like to distinguish, or the distinction I'd like to make right up front is when you're thinking of projects of very large scope or that can ultimately be of very, very large scale, there are really two breeds, I think. The first breed is one I encountered a lot at Burning Man. I just got back from Burning Man about, I don't know, a week ago. My neurons are still recovering. But where you'd encounter, so you'd run into someone and you'd say, oh, yeah, so what do you do in real life? Or what do you do when you're not at Burning Man? And they would say something like, oh, yeah, I'm solving world peace. That's what I do. Yeah, okay. All right, good luck with that. And so that's what I would call daydreaming, with no practical plan, no measurement. And a quote was mentioned yesterday, which is actually from Peter Drucker, management theorist, which is, what gets measured gets managed. So the second breed, what I would call being strategically unreasonable, is exemplified by many people, but by a friend of mine named BJ Fogg. So BJ Fogg, F-O-G-G, I'd encourage you all to Google his name, is a professor at Stanford. He's a computer scientist and a psychologist. And just by way of introducing him, what he's become very well known for in the last year or two, he taught the first Facebook applications class at Stanford. Knew very little about Facebook applications. Just decided that, say, you know, 72 hours before the registrar would close registration for new classes, you'd have a Facebook class. And the grade for each student was determined by how many users they could get for their respective applications. And within 10 weeks, they had more than 12 million users. These are students with no training, no background in anything that was taught. So he was emboldened by this to create a class focusing on world peace. So world peace within 30 years. No real curriculum, no plans, didn't know how it was going to go, what the outcome would be. And he quickly realized in the first class that they could spend the rest of the semester debating the meaning of peace. No one could come to a consensus. So what he decided, and this is the important logical translation that changes something from daydreaming into an actionable plan, is he decided to focus on what he called antecedents to peace. So what are the conditions for peace, however we personally define it, that we can agree on? Whether that's cultural appreciation, mutual understanding, let's say some type of exchange of ideas between warring neighbors. What are those antecedents that we can identify and agree on? And they identified about 50, and then by polling and voting among the students and others, decided on, let's say, 20. And for each of those 20, they designed very simple online applications, which you don't need a computer science background to do. We can go into that later if you want, where they could track the before and after effects with ratings and so forth for these various antecedents. And based on that, they're able to track progress with specific milestones that they think will catalyze change on a larger scale, national, governmental, et cetera. So that is a very actionable example of thinking big and planning very small. From my personal experience, I'll give another example. The 4-Hour Workweek. So I'm the author of a book called The 4-Hour Workweek. And that book came out about a year and a half ago. The book was turned down by 15 publishers, at least, violently by most. The title initially was Drug Dealing for Fun and Profit, which I found very clever and tongue-in-cheek reference to my lectures at Princeton. Walmart didn't find it quite as amusing. And the book was really an afterthought on the part of the publisher, and I don't necessarily blame them for this. More than 200,000 books published each year in the U.S. alone, but it was stuck in the back of the catalog. No real planned offline promotion or marketing or PR. And I actually approached the president of one of the largest online booksellers, business booksellers, to do a PR joint partnership. And as a favor to the publisher, he took my call. And he sort of listened, waiting for his turn to talk, and said, okay. Because I explained I wanted to hit both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal list. And being preferably number one, of course. And I was in the process of laying out my plan for doing so. And he said, look, let me just explain the reality of the situation. So he went on to bring me down to realistic standards. And went so far as to send me 2 PDFs of historical numbers showing percentages and so forth and why it was, in effect, impossible for me to have a bestseller. It's like, okay, well, thank you very much. I listened very politely, and that was the end of the conversation. The book ended up hitting the New York Times and Wall Street Journal the first week with no offline PR promotion, and was simultaneously number one in the New York Times, Business Week, and Wall Street Journal, and a year and a half later, still on all of those lists and has been sold into 31 languages. So obviously, there's a huge discrepancy between what I was told and what actually happened. And I'll get to some of the reasons for that at the end when I'll discuss how I think you can convert lack of resources into strength. The second example that I want to give from my personal experience is not related to a for-profit product at all, but related to something that I find of great importance, paramount importance, at least in the U.S. and elsewhere, education. So I set this outrageous goal of trying to double the number of science and math majors in the U.S. in the next 10 years. Because I really don't want the trend of Americans thinking that Adam and Eve rode to their wedding on a dinosaur to continue. And I find that problematic. It doesn't lend itself to logical problem solving very well. And so I made this my stated objective. And if you want to change the world, if you want to really have an impact and leave a footprint, a positive footprint, you're going to have to recruit people. Very important that you recruit people who take action. And to that end, you have to have sufficiently ambitious goal. People want to be part of history. And if you provide them with the opportunity to do that, even if you ultimately fail, it highly increases the likelihood of their participation. So to double the number of science and math majors in the US but in the next 10 years, and then also to spread literacy through developing countries so they have an alternative in some countries to, let's say, extremist madrasa schools. And I had no experience in fundraising, no experience in education, no experience building schools, certainly. And what I did, first of all, is I made sure that my message was extremely clear. So people can hate you, they can dislike you, but they shouldn't be confused by your message. It should be very, very clear. Secondly, what I did is I found what in retail you might call an anchor tenant. All right, so an anchor tenant in retail, let's say you're a developer, you have a new mall, you need an anchor tenant, someone with reputation, someone with presence who will draw in the rest of those tenants. In the case of nonprofits, causes, and so forth, this anchor tenant is often a celebrity or someone who has a following of their own. And just as in retail, oftentimes you have to buy that first tenant. So if you're asking, let's say, people for fundraising, rather than going to celebrities and asking them to donate money, you say, okay, I would like to donate $2,000 in your name. Is that all right? And then as soon as you get one or two of them, that's when it begins to cascade. And that's exactly what I did for Lit Liberation. So the name of the campaign was Lit Liberation, which can be shortened to Lit Lib, which is very easy to type and has alliteration and will spread very quickly online. I firmly believe that the online blogosphere and extensions of that is the new battlefield for mindshare. If you want to have an enormous impact very quickly with no resources, no capital, that is one of the easiest places to do it. What I ended up doing then is found myself stuck without resources in Bratislava. I won't go into detail. I was in Bratislava with nothing but my laptop, and I had some last-minute snags, like you always will. And I couldn't get my developer, I couldn't get all the people together who needed to put the site up by the date that was targeted. So I went to WordPress.com, which I highly recommend you check out also, not as a blog necessarily, but as a platform for content management of any type. Went to WordPress.com, set up a website with a few photos in about 5 hours, and launched this campaign. The way I did it with no resources is I found pre-existing architecture. So what that means is there is a site called firstgiving.org. If you go to firstgiving, it allows people to create campaign pages with thermometers and so forth for certain goals that they set. And I routed the school funds. So people chose. You have to make it very easy for people. There's a paradox of choice effect. If you say, hey, be part of our campaign, here are 12 things you can do, no one's going to do anything. You have to say, here are two options, just like in advertising. If you say, here are 10 different options for a watch that you can purchase versus here are two options, you'll generally have a 3x, 4x response rate. It's very similar. So what I said is you have to choose if you want to do domestic or international. If you do international, this is the process. If you do domestic, here's the process. Domestic would be routed to people or rather to the organization DonorsChoose.org. This is one of the most impressive social entrepreneurship projects I've ever seen, DonorsChoose.org. If you did international, get routed through First Giving, and then to roomtoread.org. So what's the upshot of all this? The upshot of all this is no resources, no money, no experience, competing against other people in fundraising. That was another part of this. It made it a competition. We ended up raising, the goal was $1 million, ended up raising more than $250,000 in the first 2 weeks, and have since exceeded $1 million easily. Have built probably close to a dozen schools in places like Nepal, India, Vietnam that are either completed or under construction. And to put that in comparative terms, does anyone here know who Stephen Colbert is? Colbert Report? It's a very famous TV show in the US, extremely popular, one of those popular evening shows in the US. He was also pushing people to go to Donors Choose just before the writer's strike. He had an episode where he spent a lot of time pushing people to the website. It was rebroadcast 10 times during those 2 weeks that we were campaigning, and we outraised him by 3x. TechCrunch and Engadget, two of the largest blogs in the world, outraised them by about 8x. This is with very little audience, comparatively, no money, no experience. And what we also did, this is a crux point, and then I'll move on to other stuff. It's important to look at the why. Why did we outraise TechCrunch and Engadget? They have millions, tens of millions of people at their disposal. The reason that we outraised them is that TechCrunch had a TechCrunch page. Please contribute to the TechCrunch page and help literacy and help this. Help isn't specific enough. You need to make it specific, first of all. Engadget did the same thing. What we did, I didn't have a Tim Ferriss page. I did, but I funded it myself. But what I said is, this is going to be a fundraising competition. This will be the largest online educational fundraising experiment in history. People like to be part of history. Tell me more about it. Here's what you do. You create using our software, your own donation page. So you don't have to contribute your own money. Whoever is the most intelligent fundraiser, using any means at their disposal, has a chance to win prizes, including, let's say, a tour of YouTube headquarters meeting the CEO, or a one-of-a-kind piece of artwork from an artist that does work for the Sultan of Brunei, Andre Agassi, so forth and so on. All of these people were willing to be part of it because I allowed them also to be part of history and the exposure and so forth and so on. None of it cost anything. So that's an example from the social landscape. And the next time that I do this, I'm going to really try very hard to look at it exponentially and not linearly. What that means is, people are not attracted to incremental gains. If you say, let's go from, all we need to do is 5%. We're going to improve 5% on last year's performance. That does not make the blood boil. So what I did recently is I sat down with a few people in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is a great place if you want to find unreasonable things happening all the time. And just had a cup of coffee with a few people who've been involved with Kiva.org and a few other organizations that have done extremely interesting things in the philanthropic space and environmental space. And I said, okay, well, what if we tried to raise $1 million in one day? Or what if we tried to build 100 schools in one day? So, okay, we've built 10 schools in, let's say, 6 weeks. What if we tried to do 100 in one day? What would that look like? How would we do that? And they got really excited. If I had said anything else, if I'd said, okay, let's see what we could do to build 20 schools, they wouldn't have wanted to have any part of it. So thinking exponentially, I think, is extremely important. I will jump right into this, and then I'll give a few examples that I think can help, and I want to jump into the Q&A. So this is from a blog post of mine called From Shanghai to Silicon Valley, Three Tips for Turning Lack of Resources into Strength. And there's more to it. I encourage people to take a look at it. But here's the gist of it. So Alibaba.com, which pairs non-Chinese companies with Chinese suppliers, wrote its IPO, initial public offering, to a $26 billion valuation. Its founder, Jack Ma, explains his secret for success. There were three reasons why we survived. We had no money, we had no technology, and we had no plan. Every dollar we used very, very carefully. All right, so let that sink in for a moment. Excuses not to jump into the unknown are a dime a dozen. In the case of entrepreneurship, the I don't have list. So entrepreneurship, in the sense of how it was coined by J.B. Say, is moving resources from an area of low economic yield or low impact to an area of high economic yield or high impact. You do not have to be self-employed to be an entrepreneur, nor does it have to be for-profit. The I don't have list, I don't have funding, I don't have connections, et cetera, is popular write-off for inaction. Little do most people know how often lack of resources is the ingredient that creates great companies or causes or movements. It forces you to be clever, to dissect problems instead of throwing cash at them, and to innovate instead of imitating better-funded competitors or dissenters, in the case of BAA, or you name it. Florida-based PR agency Crispin Porter & Boguski, there's a link on my site, I won't let you write that down, is a great example of this, as are a few little enterprises you might recognize. Microsoft and Nike come to mind, that started with less than $10,000 in funding. There's often an inverse relationship between the amount of funding and the ultimate success of companies. Inverse relationship. And there are many investors who are now taking that tack and really act as micro investors, which is what I am as well in Silicon Valley. So how do you reevaluate your weaknesses? Whatever they might be, I have my weaknesses. There are lots of them. I have my insecurities. Everyone is insecure. Everyone. It's not just people sitting in this room. So how do you reevaluate and reposition your weaknesses? Number one, write down the positives of whatever you've been viewing as a negative. Don't know anyone, you'll be a fresh face and won't have any strikes against you. This is very very much parallel with Obama in some respects. Okay, well, for his lack of experience, what does he gain? Well, he's not beholden to corporate interest, etc. Although I don't believe that, but there are benefits. No funding, it will force you to find the neglected options and set trends instead of following them. So as a four-hour work week, side note, I said I would get back to this. I focused on blogs for the four-hour work week because I essentially had no other options. It was really the only card I had to play. It was the area where the publishers weren't actively involved. I didn't have the budget for a massive national print campaign, even though I've run campaigns on radio for more than 150 stations. I have that experience. I didn't have the right, because they wanted the right to control most of it, to do any of those things. If I had had the money, if I had had the options, I probably would have succumbed, as unreasonable as I am, to peer pressure as a first-time author and wasted all of my resources on those outlets. Instead, I went with my only option, which was blogs. And that's why it sold out on Amazon. I hit the list based on Amazon. That's it. It had 13,000 copies distributed when it was initially printed. Now it has well over 600,000 in the US. But it was all online activism, essentially. Number two, consider the negatives of the opposites. All right, so bear with me here. What if you had too much funding? I don't know if anyone's familiar with Webvan. You might want to take a look at that as one great example of how to waste money when you have too much. What if you had too much funding? It would create a false sense of security and breed complacency, both of which are more fatal to a startup than bootstrapping. It could also overexpose you before your product or service is ready. You don't want to make your debut in the New York Times when you're not ready. Get your practice online first or at smaller types of events that don't get the media coverage. If you give investors or partners too much influence over big decisions, fatal equally. Don't assume more of something is 100% positive. It never is. It never, ever is. So look at the negatives of having the most of whatever resource you lack. Number three, this is extremely, extremely important, and this is what I look for when I'm facing my own personal demons, my own personal fears, my own insecurities. Look for dark horse role models. So what is a dark horse role model? Let's just say, I can't start a company, I'm too old. Well, Colonel Sanders, I don't know how many of you know who that is here, who started Kentucky Fried Chicken, apparently called KFC now because they can't call it chicken, but I don't know if that's real. Colonel Sanders started KFC after age 40. The excuses just don't hold up. So if you can't compete in sports because of a bum leg, well, you can look at, let's just say, Oscar Pistorius of Australia. He just barely, by the thinnest margin, missed qualifying for the Olympic team in sprinting. So, again, doesn't hold up. For each reason for an action you can come up with, ask, has anyone overcome these or worse circumstances to do what I want to do? The answer is, of course. There are a few resources I'd recommend you look at. There's an excellent book called Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, by John Wood, W-O-O-D, who's founder of Room to Read. They've built, I think, more than 8,000 schools in less than 8 years. All right, it's a very interesting financial model. Very interesting to see his positioning, and I'm going to quote his shareholder letter in a moment because I received it. Other resources would include Banker to the Poor, if no one has read that, Muhammad Yunus. Again, a very fascinating look at thinking big but planning small. So I'm going to close with just two quotes, and then we'll jump into Q&A. So the first quote is from the letter from John Wood, and here it is. There's a Marianne Williamson quotation that's often attributed to Nelson Mandela that speaks to his topic of thinking big. Quote, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. Your playing small does not serve the world." So don't think small. It doesn't serve you. It doesn't serve the world around you. It doesn't serve the people around you. If your goal, if your real dream is to go, let's just say, use a personal example, go to Greece and sail the crystal waters and drink fine wine and eat 20 pounds of feta cheese every day. If you step that back to a realistic goal of, let's say, going to Madrid for a weekend or going to Columbus, Ohio for the weekend, when you hit your first obstacle, you're not going to change your brand of cereal to accomplish that mediocre goal. You need something that will provide you with a certain number of hit points, so to speak, to use Dungeons and Dragons parlance, so that for each obstacle you still maintain that enthusiasm necessary to take difficult steps and have the uncomfortable conversations that often determine success in any field. The last quote. This is by M.C. Escher from Physics of the Impossible by Michio Kaku. Only those who attempt the absurd will achieve the impossible. All right? So listen to advice, listen to experts, but listen to people who have done something on the scale of what you want to do. I could have listened to the president who told me it couldn't be done. It was impossible. Kid, let me tell you how it works. I could have listened to him. Nothing, none of this would have happened. I wouldn't be here speaking right now. But he's never had a best-selling book. How does he know what's involved? How does he understand the decisions that are made? What goes into that? All of the doubts, all of the fears. He doesn't. So if you're going to ask someone for advice, feel free to listen to anyone who offers, but really only listen to people who have done it, people who have accomplished the uncommon. And with that, I'd like to jump into Q&A. So thank you very much for having me.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.